Okay. Well, Herbert asked me to talk about milk results, basically. Even so, this is more a numerical, phenomenological in that sense talk, and so doesn't quite fit into the programs of these past 3 weeks. Pardon? You need a relief, yes. Of course, it's somewhat unfortunate that our chairman is not here today, because the results that I'm trying to, that I'm talking about might be some answer to a challenge of his, namely, do we do anything useful with the huge amount of computer time that we have been consuming in the past few years, or do the collaboration that I'm part of is just get older? But anyway, let me go on. So the cast of characters, the main cast of characters involved, this is are shown here. This is a snapshot of last January, and actually the younger people here have all moved on. Eric, Chris, Oben, and James Osborne, they are now in different locations. Some part of the results that I'll talk with have been obtained in collaboration with HPQCD, UKQCD, and I guess I forgot Fermilab here, collaboration, so sorry, guys. I'll talk, so this is a brief outline of the talk. I'll talk about the ensemble of configurations, the algorithm, and so on. Give the results highlight or some kind of summary plot. Then we'll discuss in more detail the pseudoscalar sector, where we have the most precise data. Show some graphs about other meson masses, baryons. Talk about topology and some other project with milk configurations, and just go on as long as I have time, or as long as we get with the time. So when we plan to carry out the simulation, we must select certain parameters. We select the lattice spacing, or actually that's always done indirectly. We select the gauge coupling and determine the lattice spacing. We have to select the grid size, and we have to select the quark masses with which to we do our simulations. Then to get results with controlled systematic errors, we have to take the continuum limit, we have to take the infinite volume limit, or at least make sure that the volume is large enough so that the finite size effects are under control. We have to extrapolate to the physical light quark mass, even with the relatively easy fermions that I'll talk about, staggered. We have not been able to reach the physical light quark masses. We've reached masses that are basically factor 2.5 to 3, still too heavy. On the other hand, we can work at the physical S quark mass, or at least we can interpolate to it. Doing a we also must choose an action, a lattice action, and a simulation algorithm. So for the gauge action, we used the one-loop improved Lüscher-Weiss action, which has order alpha S squared A squared discretization effects. For the fermions, we used a three-level improved staggered action with a fat type of link. The fat link is chosen in such a way to suppress taste violations, that taste violations are induced by exchange of very ultraviolet gluons. So the fat link is chosen to suppress the gluons with momenta near the borders of the Brillouin zone. In staggered fermions, different corners of the Brillouin zone are associated with different taste slash spin indices. So I use taste here for to describe the doubling of staggered fermions to distinguish them from the flavors U, D, and S that we actually want to simulate. The algorithm that we use is a hybrid molecular dynamics, our algorithm. And since staggered fermions nominally correspond to four tastes, to reduce that to one taste, we use this fourth root of the determinant trick to eliminate the extra tastes. Now, as you all know, there is whatever this determinant to the fourth root trick is, it induces non-localities, so problems in the continuum limit in the interacting theory is still an open question. I think in the free theory, the question has been solved in recent months. It was kind of obvious already from the early 80s paper, Kohlberg, Stern, and so on, that in the free theory, in the continuum limit, one produces four decoupled tastes. Now, our results so far show no signs that there could be a problem, but of course, that doesn't mean that there isn't. So this is an open question. And I thought we will have some informal discussion about this problem, but while I'm here, but maybe not.
I think actually, sometime next week, we should give this start. I guess one technical question. You don't actually take a quarter of the term, right? You put a quarter in front of the evolution of the gauge field.
Well, we write the determinant as trace log of the operator, and then we take the fourth, then we put the one-fourth in
so,
there.
I'm just trying to get this technical thing. So as you're evolving the gauge fields of this molecular dynamics,
yes,
there's a certain term in the force.
Yes.
And you put a quarter in front of the force.
That's correct.
Now, does the quarter come in anywhere else?
No.
For instance, when you're doing the pseudofermion part, the pseudofermion is generated with the...
No, this is the molecular R algorithm. So when we write down the equation of motion, so we write the effective action as 1/4 trace log of the fermion determinant. If you do, so the in the so that then in the fourth you have a term that goes like 1/4 trace of dm du times m inverse. And then this trace is computed with a random source. That's the R algorithm.
Right.
So the fourth root comes in by this coefficient 1/4.
Okay. But you're absolutely right. That's the only thing going forward.
Okay. Oops. Went a little bit too far. Fast. So we've been generating configurations with this action, and for several years now. I don't recall when we started, 4 years ago. So far, at two different lattice spacings that we try to keep constant when we change the quark mass, and several quark masses, one strange quark mass and several light quark masses. Some of the newer configurations on the finer lattice have been generated with SIDAC resources. The rest have been generated with resources that the Milk Collaboration got from national supercomputer centers. So these are the newer ensembles, and this is kind of the remainder of the list. So we then went down to with light quark masses that are nominally 1/10 of the strange quark mass, or the strange quark mass that we simulated at. The number of configurations you can see, and here is the quark content. When changing the quark mass, we adjusted the coupling 10 over g squared in such a way that the lattice spacing as measured, or one measure of the lattice spacing was kept constant. That measure was distance, which we call R1, which is defined as that the R squared times the force is equal to 1. So this is like the summer scale, except for the summer scale, the one it would be 1.65. And the distance in Fermi is, as we find out afterwards, what is about is 0.317 Fermi, R1. Okay, this is an impression of where we are, plotted from m pi over m rho. We have both on the fine lattice, 0.09 Fermi, and the coarse lattice, about 0.125 Fermi. We have also matched quenched ensembles, and then several lighter quarks. The physical volume, we try to keep always about 2.5 Fermi or larger. In particular, for the lightest point, we went larger, and we have one quark mass on the coarse lattice, namely when the light quarks are 1/5 of the strange quark, we have actually two volumes to directly check for finite volume effects. Okay, and then I should mention that all our ensembles, all our configurations are publicly available at NERSC, at the gauge connection at NERSC, or at least there soon after we generate them, we usually transfer them over there. So the first results is the ratio plot that you've probably all seen, comparing quenched with our NF equals 3 results. Observables that Milk computed without help, and then by sharing our lattices with other groups that do heavy quark physics or heavy light physics, we have a whole set of measurements that from which we can compare then to nature. And you can see that in the quench theory, there's a 10-15% spread around one in these results. However, then for the NF equals 3, the three flavor continuum extrapolated, everything lines up with about within about 2 or 3% errors around one. At the end of the day, the lattice scale was actually set by the 1P1S splitting in the Potomac.
1S2S.
Or,
huh?
1S2S. 1S2S splitting. Well, I think they agree basically within.
Yeah, as you see.
As you see. Okay. So, anyway. And so, what we did was we made a continuum extrapolation of the ratio of R1 versus this mass times this mass difference to figure out what R1 in the continuum limit would be in QCD.
So, maybe just a question in physics. I understand why F pi could be very sensitive to that. Why is the upsilon, the 1P1S, was so sensitive?
Because that is sensitive to the short distance part of the potential, which is much more curved. I mean, the Coulomb potential runs because of the different running of the coupling in quenched and unquenched physics.
But why this particular?
I don't.
1S is so sensitive. Okay.
Okay, let's go now to discuss the results that of Milk in the pseudoscalar sector. The pseudoscalar sector, we have the most precise data. Pions are easiest to measure. And we have lots of measurements because we measured also partially quenched. So we varied the valence quark differently from the C quark masses. Then since we need to do chiral extrapolation, and we know what the form of chiral extrapolation should be, that should be governed by chiral perturbation theory, we'll of course make the fits to chiral perturbation theory. And since chiral perturbation theory governs both the effects on f pi and m pi, then we would like to make fits together. If we do fits to the continuum form of chiral perturbation theory, they just don't work. It's easy to understand, of course, when you think a little bit, because we're simulating at finite lattice spacing. And at finite lattice spacing, for one of the big important effects with staggered fermions is state symmetry breaking. State symmetry breaking tells us that there is only one pion that is a Goldstone pion, and the other would be Goldstone pions. They have masses that are different at order alpha, but for our action at order alpha squared a squared, so they're taste violations. And since an important contribution in these the chiral perturbation theory form are this m pi squared log m pi, the chiral logs, of course, it is important to take into account that the masses in this in these logs are not all the same for all the pions that run around in internal loops. Now, yes?
I have a question, which is also partly maybe a comment for some other people here. So you say that the chiral perturbation theory does not work in the sense that if you really try to fit this, you get this lousy confidence. However, if you try to be less intelligent, uh-huh, your smallest lattice spacing and your smallest quark masses, and you just did the extrapolation, I think you would find that you get very close to the physical answer. And that you can do with staggered quarks, and you cannot do with any other kind of quark with the computers that we have right now.
Yeah.
So even though there's a sense in which this fit does not work, there's another sense in which it works better than it would for
other fermions. Right. But since we have really good data, we want to squeeze out the most physics of it. Okay. And also, we want to make sure that we actually
I was making the comment that both points of view are important.
And especially, you also want to put some confidence on your extrapolation. Okay.
For some people, confidence depends on other things.
That too. Yes. Okay. Granted. So, the chiral perturbation theory apparatus has been extended to include these effects of the staggered fermions, the taste violations, plus the fact that we have order a squared effects also in other quantities, and we're trying to fit data for two different lattice spacing. This was worked out in gory detail by Chris Aubin and Claude Bernard, based on work by Leon Sharp and others. So we take this staggered chiral perturbation theory. As I said, we fit the coarse and the fine lattices together. From the chiral logarithms, we can actually compute what happens when you do the chiral perturbation theory on a finite volume, and so you can account for some small finite volume corrections. So we include those small finite volume corrections. They never exceed more than 1%. Then after the fit, we can extrapolate the fit parameters to the continuum limit. And of course, we had to choose the strange quark mass, which we simulated before we did the simulation. So we had to make some educated guess. And at the end of the day, the educated guess was somewhat off, or some 20% off on the coarser lattice, and I think a little bit more than 10% off on the finer lattice. But within the chiral perturbation theory form, we can correct again for that. So that will be shown. Details are written up in a longish paper. So again, we fit partially quenched f pi and m pi simultaneously now with the taste violations, and the fits work much, much better.
Maybe I could
should be able to calculate, but what is the range of quark masses you are actually exploring? I mean, this
R1,
you said what it is, but
the what we typically include in the fit, I mean, it varies the range, the range of the quark masses, but typically we include in the fit masses that go up to about 0.7 times the strange quark mass.
So
okay, so, seven, well, no.
And is this
we claim that the strange quark mass is...
Okay, whatever, so 0.7.
Yeah.
So is this a simultaneous fit of F pi and N pi?
Yes. On the partially quenched fine coarse lattices, all the data together. And I show here two different confidence levels. Some of the parameters we restrict by kind of by priors to prevent runaway solutions. And so you can compute either by adding the chi-squareds also of those parameters and use them as degrees of freedom or not. But in this case, actually, confidence level doesn't change if either way, which means that the priors that we chose are very reasonable. But the fit works well.
Sorry, continuation of my previous question. So this 0.7 is the lightest prior?
No, the largest.
The largest
Whalen. The largest
pseudoscalars. You have a
you can point. These diamonds on the right.
And these diamonds are from one C quark mass ratio, and then the boxes, the squares, are different valence quarks. So the partially quenched calculation.
These diamonds on the right, higher up, that's the light quark mass is about 0.6 of the strange quark.
Yeah, this one up here.
And you go all the way down to
1/10.
Okay.
And then the valence quark, the valence quarks, we also restrict to about 0.7. So the only mass that is larger than 0.7, or so the strange quark mass, is the C strange quark mass, because we have only one simulation there. Okay. So then we can extrapolate the fit parameters to the continuum. It gives here for f pi, and can go to full QCD, so set the C quarks equal to the valence quarks. When we do that, then we can do consistency checks, extrapolate actual data points to the continuum limit. Works nice. And then we can correct within the chiral perturbation theory formula for the fact that the correct strange quark mass is somewhat different from the one that we used for simulation. You can see here that and then for f pi, the effect is very, very small. Similar procedure we can do for fk, where fk is the decay constant of k plus. And in the decay constant, you can see the slight curvature from the chiral logs. If you would look by eye at the plot of m pi squared versus quark mass, you couldn't by eye distinguish, see that they're not straight line. However, when we divide out the quark masses,
back up one.
The FK.
So the experimental result, is that the old one before VUS was revised by KTEV and NA48 and so on?
I think that's the one that's in the particle data book. I mean, in the last 2000, well, I mean.
It's changing any day now.
This is the one that I got out of the plot that Claude showed. This plot is the one that's in the paper, and Claude, so it's from last summer.
So what's measured in K on the K is VUS.
Yes.
Times FK.
Yes.
And VUS was out of whack.
Well, there is still some controversy about VUS.
I don't think so.
I'll come to VUS again later. So anyway, so if you divide out the quark mass, then you see the chiral lock curvature also in the pseudoscalar mass. And here is a graph that is supposed to, that shows the convergence of the chiral perturbation theory. So we have the lowest order, the chiral limit, meaning the chiral limit of U and T quark. It's different because the strange quark is not, I mean, is different from zero. The lowest next to leading order parts, and then with next to leading order analytic parts, and our data point. So obvious. So in the region where we apply chiral perturbation theory, the convergence seems to be quite nice. Now we want to determine light quark masses, and so we have to be careful. We have to take into account that the experimental masses, of course, contain electromagnetic and isospin violating effects. Whereas when we simulated with degenerate U and T quark. So we have the experimental masses, then one can try to figure out what the masses would be without the electromagnetic effects, and then the mass, what the masses should be in the isospin limit. For the pion in the isospin limit is basically the pi naught, which doesn't have sizable electromagnetic effects. For the kaon, it's the average of the k naught and the k plus. And then the electromagnetic effects are parameterized by a parameter delta, where delta equals zero means that the electromagnetic effects in the kaon and pion sector are the same, and that's referred to as Dashen theorem. Now there have been various continuum investigations of these effects. They suggest that this parameter delta E is about one. So so there are actually sizable violations to Dashen's theorem. When we do our analysis, since we don't know delta E, we vary delta E in this interval from 0 to 2, and that will have the differences that we get will quote as an error. I show a graph that basically shows how we find pi hat and k hat, the isospin limit QCD masses, so the masses with the electromagnetic effects turned off. This is, we had to have to iterate a few times through our fits and just both the light quark masses and the strange quark masses until both the continuum extrapolated points hit the kaon and pion point.
You know, some people suggested, Mike probably knows about it a lot, that mu vanishes, for example.
Yeah, I'll come to that.
You can test that?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. So, finding mu, that's the next slide. So now, so we have the average light mu. UD quark masses we found from looking at k hat to go to find the u quark we go on to extrapolate down to K plus, where now we only change the valence quark mass. So this in this green portion, and then we find ratio of mu over ms, so as plotted here, when this extrapolation hits the value for K plus. Now there is a small error in that, because in the C we still have isospin. So we've went away from the isospin limit in the valence quarks here, but not in the C quarks. So there is a small systematic effect still. But so from the previous two graphs, then we can determine what the ratio of mu over md is. It's given here with the statistical kind of other systematic errors and electromagnetic uncertainty. So the last error comes from varying this delta E parameter between 0 and 2. So that, we believe, is a conservative estimate of the electromagnetic effects. There is a paper by Beijing, or however you pronounce his name.
Binance.
Okay, thank you. And Brothers, who claim that this parameter is this, in particular, has a quarter of the error of what we assume. We assume basic 1 plus minus 1. And so when one uses that, then the last error goes obviously down by a factor of 4, but the central value changes only very little. Then our friends from HPQCD, they have computed one-loop mass renormalization for our fermion, for our action. And so then we can convert our results, our Bayer lattice results that we had, into MS bar numbers evaluated at 2 GeV, and which is given here. And here the errors are statistical, simulation systematics, perturbation theory, and if applicable, electromagnetic. And the zero means always that it's rounded down to zero, so it's less than 1/2. Or when we use the mu-md ratio from the past, we find that the average light quark mass, which is 2.8, splits into a u that is 1.7 and a d that is 3.9.
Oops.
Pardon?
I thought it was one more kind of error. Four different kinds of errors.
Yeah, you can. Okay.
It should be praise rather than criticism.
That's careful.
You can always see the answer.
Well, you can add them up in quadrature, basically. We show that we can say exactly. I mean, you just add them up in quadrature. So anyway, we also have numbers for f pi, fk, and fk over f pi. And so these are the experimental numbers that we used. I don't, so you figure out what data of the particle data group result this is. Now, Marciano has shown that with the lattice ratio of fk over f pi, and the experimental measurements of fk over f pi, one can deduce vus. And when we put in our numbers for that, this is what we get. The particle data group value at that time was this. So the error, our lattice error, well, this error is dominated by the lattice error, but of course also contains the experimental error here, is actually comparable to the world average at that time. Unitarity holds pretty good, a little bit better than it held in the particle data group. But there is this recent KTEF result, which for which VUS is even larger. The our chiral fits also give us some low energy chiral constant, Lloyd-Wheeler cluster constant, which are listed here. They're consistent with what one conventionally assumes. Not surprising, of course, the result for 2L8 minus L5 excludes, in this scenario, mu equals zero, but this is, of course, not an independent from our directed determination. Now,
at some point,
Mike will tell you that mu equals zero is actually not well defined. But since we're away from zero, I don't think we're in any danger of having to change our conclusions. So that's so far about the pseudoscalar sector. In the pseudoscalar sector, where we have good results, we can actually, in our correlator, get excited states. So these are not simulations that were tuned to, or measurements that were made to determine these excited states. We didn't do propagators with different sources and made some sophisticated analysis. This is just from a single propagator doing a two-state, or I mean a fit that includes an excited state. So the errors and spread, of course, here is not quite as well, but certainly the order of magnitude of the mass in the excited channel is where one would expect it to be.
What do you mean is double exponential? Two
exponential constants. Yes. So with one correlator fitted to a sum of two exponential, not just one.
Yeah. Okay. The light blue error bars are meaning what?
These are, I think, the smaller error bars are the statistical errors on a particular fit, on the best fit. Mm-hmm. And if you change the range of fits, you see differences. And that's indicated by the lighter error bars here. Then we can also do that in the kaon channel, so where we have different different valence quarks masses in the two propagators. Now I should mention that in the staggered, with staggered fermions in most channels, you have the channel that you're interested in, and you have a channel with the opposite parity that has an alternating sign, so it goes like minus one and then something. Now for the pseudoscalar that I showed before with degenerate quarks, the opposite parity is forbidden. The opposite parity state is forbidden. However, in principle, if you don't have degenerate quarks, that's no longer the case. And indeed, when we fit the kaon, when we do excited state fits on the kaon, we see an opposite parity channel plus then an excited in the same, with the same parity as before. And interestingly enough, the energy of that opposite parity channel is very close to pi plus k. This happens when we fit on a dynamical ensemble, but not when we do the same fit on the quenched ensemble. Now, in a quenched calculation, this opposite parity partner of the k, which is not a stable state, it seems to have a too high energy. In the quenched calculation, however, that channel can couple to a basically decay product, phi plus k product, only, of course, in the dynamical. So we find that rather intriguing that we don't see a signal for this at all in a quenched, but we do see it on a dynamical ensemble. So the summary of K and its excited state is then shown here.
MK here is supposed to be the Suvus carrier, the Goldstone MK. Am I correct?
Well, except that it has different masses. As a one quark propagator with mass M light and one quark propagator with mass M strange.
But the combination is pseudo-Goldstone of the stellar plane.
Yeah, yes.
And that...
That with degenerate quarks does not have a state in the opposite parity, but when you don't have degenerate quarks, that's no longer true.
I see.
We have, of course, measured also the vector particles, and I show. Fits, it's a function of d min, so these are fits that start at different time slices for one particular ensemble, the rho k star, so we have different valence quark masses again, and then an SS bar state, the phi up here. So these are, gives you some impression of the plateaus we have in our simulation here. The masses are assembled and then compared to the continuum, to the experimental values, where the error bars here come from our error on R1, basically. just briefly, the plot of the so called J parameter, which is one quantity that seems to be sensitive to C-quark effects in quenched simulation tends to be low in dynamical simulation. It's the difference, what is it exactly? It's the difference between the vector the K star, MK star, and M rho divided by something in the pseudo-scalar sector.
So the difference in the pseudo-scalar is the denominator, means it's supposed to be, morally speaking, the derivative of the vector meson mass with respect to the quark mass.
Yes, except that you use...
So it's a difference in vector meson mass is upstairs, pseudo-scalar is downstairs, so you get this derivative.
Was first introduced by Chris Michael, I think. Then we have also measured nucleons. Nucleons so far we've measured only with valence quarks equal to C quark mass and have only rough continuum chiral extrapolations. We have, concentrate on the red point. We have three flavor results on two lattice spacings, and we have two ensembles where the ratio of the light to the strange quark mass we have on both lattice on both the fine and the coarse lattices, and so there we can then make a naive continuum extrapolation, which gives these purple symbols there, and then one can try to see what would happen in a chiral extrapolation, and what I'm showing is just a naive chiral straight line extrapolation, and then two competing continuum chiral extrapolation forms with no free parameters because we only have 2 points, just kind of to show what could happen. We have plans, we are considering doing partially quenched simulations also here. And I think Claude has a new student who is considering doing actually the staggered versions of these chiral nucleon chiral perturbation theory extrapolations. So we'll see where that leads to. And then we can also measure the omega minus baryon with a crude continuum chiral extrapolation shown here. This is actually of some interest because it's a different way of determining the strange quark mass. With our current errors, of course, much less precise than from the pseudoscalar sector, but as you can see from the agreement, I mean, obviously, not, they agree completely. Granted, due to the rather large errors, it's not a very stringent test. And how am I doing on time?
Well, actually, we're pretty
well. Okay. So let me go on now to some other things. So one is topology with staggered fermions, which could be somewhat of a problem. We know that the topological susceptibility at small quark masses depends on the number of flavors, and we know actually how it depends. And there's always the danger that fermions that don't have exact zero modes might not see topology really correctly. And so we try to measure topologies. Of course, there is some uncertainty in the measurements themselves, but anyway. And then we try to analyze those for the 2+1 flavor simulations, or actually, part of the collaboration did that. They looked at what would be the expected form, the expected dependence of the topology, the topological susceptibility to the pseudoscalar masses for staggered fermions. Again, recall, staggered fermions, we have one Goldstone pion per flavor, and then others that are non-degenerate. And it actually turns out that the formula that one gets looks very much like the continuum formula, except that the pion that appears, not surprisingly, is a taste singlet pion, which happens to be the heaviest of all the pions at the given lattice spacing due to the taste symmetry breaking. And included here is also the M0 parameter that would describe the topological susceptibility and the quench limit. So this is a formula that kind of inspired by Dürr first that would also interpolate between dynamical and quenched results. And this is an illustration of what happened. So here we plot the susceptibility first as a function of the Goldstone pion, which is not the one that appears in the formula, and or plotted against the taste singlet pion. At our two lattice spacings and then a continuum extrapolation. And first of all, the lattice artifacts, which here kind of looked artificially large, look much more reasonable when one plots them against what one should plot them against. And the continuum extrapolation does lie on the expected on the expected form. So we don't.
Is that a theoretical expectation or more like a model of the full parameters?
No, that no, the expectation is basically the Lloyd-Wheeler-Schmilger form adjusted for staggered chiral for the staggered chiral Lagrangian.
So back up one.
So the masses here are measured. F we can determine in principle from the chiral Lagrangian from the fits that we had before.
And not is that fit, or is that taken from
Stefan? Do you have some answer? I think M not is taken from. From the quench limit. So you know what that is. That's kind of a phenomenon.
So to answer Paul's question, you determined all those things elsewhere apart from what you're showing on the plot. And
for the line that is shown.
Because it should be really both here. I seem to remember his talk, and he basically cooked it up as just a simple toy model, and it kind of interpolated.
The M not dependence is kind of a toy model, but in principle, actually, if you do partially quenched thing, you have to treat you have to put it in your chiral Lagrangian also. So in some sense,
I don't think Dürer was trying to pretend that this was a calculation; it was just illustration.
It's something that approach that in the infinite. Pi on going to infinity limit basically produces the quenched.
Right.
So in that sense it's phenomenological, but the form itself, all these parameters are determined except and not we have ideas of what it should be.
You say because it's divided by 1 plus m pi squared times something, and that something you split in 2.
Well, one we know, I mean, this part is rigorous.
Yeah.
Basically, 1 over chi is 1 over mu times 1 over md plus 1 over ms. And in some sense, you can transform that into pi on that, into pseudoscalar masses. And by looking at the staggered chiral Lagrangian, what we find is that the relevant pi on mass is the Tay singlet pi on mass, which is important because at our lattice spacings, the splitting is still fairly large. Okay.
What if you happen to use the Tay singlet pi on mass as a fixed lattice spacing? Do those curves go through the fixed lattice spacing data?
Pardon? In order to get these data points,
the way you presented the formula makes it sound as if it holds a fixed lattice spacing if you use the Tay singlet mass for that lattice.
Yes.
Space. So I'm asking if there's a blue curve with the blue Tay singlet pi on mass, it would go through the blue points and so on to the red points.
It should, but I'm not sure whether they have looked at that.
So you have to bug Carlton.
Yeah, this is from a paper by Billiter, Dittar, and Osborne. And then, if I have some more time, as I meant, these configurations have been used for other measurements. One that Milk started, which was kind of a continuation of work that we've done before on the dynamical configuration with standard staggered fermions, was FB, the heavy light decay constants with clover valence quarks. However, for our C quark actions, the Z factors are actually not available. So I'm showing just a plot of a ratio where the C factors should not play a crucial role. These calculations have been superseded by a better set of calculations that we've done in collaboration with the Fermilab and HPQCD, where we did the same calculations, but instead of using the clover quarks for the light quarks, we actually use the ASTAT improved staggered quarks. The advantage is that we can go to lighter valence quarks here. We can use staggered chiral perturbation theory again for chiral extrapolations down to the physical down quark mass. And here we have more knowledge about Z factors. The Z factors have been computed at one loop, and the Z factors that we actually used in the results, we wrote the heavy light Z factor as a product of the heavy heavy and light light, the square root times some correction factor, and the heavy heavy and the light light Z factors we can determine easily non-perturbatively from charge normalization. So those are then, so this part is determined non-perturbatively. The remainder is known to one loop, and the one loop correction is very, very small compared to one. So we believe that these Z factors are much under better control than a straightforward just one loop calculation would give. Here I've shown an illustration of the use of staggered chiral perturbation theory. So we have simulation results at the blue points that are then fitted to staggered chiral perturbation theory form. And then one can remove the order a squared parts off from those fits, which gives then the red curve and the extrapolated value here as the red dot here. When we analyze this, we find FDS and FD as given here. And computation for B mesons are in progress. I haven't seen results yet. Experimentally, when I first prepared this slide in October, was only experimentally unknown was only FDS. There was one candidate for this DKD plus to mu plus nu mu from Bell, I think, at that time.
Yes.
However, in the meantime, CLIO-C has been running and collecting, and they actually have 8 events for this decay with back where one expects a background of less than 1, I think. So they have enough statistics to actually quote the result, and so at least the FD number when we first produced them was a prediction, not a post-diction. Again, with the same sort of suspects, we've been looking at computing form factors for the semi-leptonic decays, D to pi or K plus the leptons, or B to pi and D, and even K to pi. So measuring this matrix element on the lattice, then the differential decay rate of the semi-leptonic decays, they're proportional to the CKM matrix square times the plus form factor here. So knowing the F plus tenant experimental decay rate allows us to extract CKM matrix element. And so this is what we find. We have in this way determined 4 of the CKM matrix elements, and think here the first error is the lattice error, and the second error is the experimental error. And then we have actually a full row of the CKM matrix, so we can check unitarity. Almost too good, of course, compared to the errors here. But it's encouraging. And some problem with fonts here. But anyway, so here is an example of the B to pi form factors, F naught and F plus, as we observe, compared to the BK form as an illustration. So this should just be an arrow there. So let me then conclude. We have done so far simulations at two lattice spacings, several C-quark masses in full 2 plus 1 flavor QCD. They've led to precision results in the pseudoscalar sector, including the K-constant Clark masses and determination of the US. We actually have a separate determination of the US from the semi-leptonic form factor on K to pi decay, which agrees, and that's about the same error concurrently. Many other what we call gold-plated observables show good agreement with experiment. That's this first plot. Gold-plated has been defined here as those are stable particles on the QCD that are far enough away from their threshold so that we have the systematics under control. As I've shown, these configurations are used for predictions for heavy light, meson decay constants, and form factors. We are still improving. Improvements that are planned or in progress is that so far we have simulated with one value of the strange quark mass at each lattice spacing. And for the coarser lattice, we want to simulate also with a smaller a strange quark mass. This is a simulation that is in progress. It has two purposes, one that we can actually interpolate to the physical strange quark mass, and secondly, that we can test our chiral fits with masses where even the C-quark masses are in the region where we believe chiral perturbation theory converges at the order that we use it. We're assembling more statistics for the lightest C-quark mass, so 1/10 of the strange quark mass, that's in progress. And then we've planned to do simulation at a third lattice spacing of about 0.06 Fermi. This is planned with SIDAC resources and in collaboration with UKQCD. And at least the US part of the simulations have been approved by the SIDAC allocation committee just a few weeks ago.
Part of it has also been approved.
Pardon?
UKQCD allocation has also been approved.
By the UKQCD collaboration, right, thank you. So,
just. QCDOCs are being built.
The QCDOC is, well, the one in Edinburgh is built, but it's being reassembled and tested and brought up to life, and yes. So, I end with a brief spectrum summary as we have it right now, where here continuum and chiral extrapolations, at least for some of these particles, were done in a rather crude way, but just to give you an impression of where we are.
Why A1 doesn't have an experimental correspondence?
One, the cross is A1 and the square is B1, or the other way around. Experimentally, they're basically degenerate. So the cross here in this box means that there are actually two states whose masses are there. One is the A1 and one is the B1. Whereas the lattice data with a crude continuum chiral extrapolation currently is there.
Those are unstable states, and these are unstable on the lattice, so you shouldn't be surprised if we have a hard time extracting masses. These are much harder to do accurately than stable particles.
So that's why the rho is also
important. Yeah, the rho, I think, on our lattices is still stable, but you have to extrapolate into the unstable region. The rho is stable because we created at zero at rest. And so It's a P wave, so the two pions have to be in a P wave, so they have to have, each one of them has to have at least the lowest momentum allowed by the size of our lattice.
Don't worry, the A1 is the parity partner of rho. When you measure it, do you use the parity partner?
Yes.
The two state signals and to determine both rho and A1?
Yes.
Or, oh, in that case, the error will probably
be
both
strings. Okay. So it's not surprised
then. Like, so the omega is not on there for some.
Pardon?
You're trying to do it.
The omega
meson.
The omega is up
here.
No,
not the omega meson. One that's near
the
small one, which is near the
singular
one.
Oh, yeah, no, we haven't tried to do untangle the flavor mix in there.
Mike, you're supposed to next notice that it doesn't have the theater, you need a prime.
Yes.
I'm not going to test. But you might think that, you know, that maybe that your confidence is a little bit high because maybe there's a little omega mixed in there or something.
Most probably, if A1 determination is an uncertainty, then most probably they will determine A1 from the raw channel, actually looking at the parity pattern. If that case, then the uncertainty of that much is understandable, because look at the error bar in A1, it's so big. So it's correlated to each other, actually. It looks like a different data, but actually it may not be. It may be the one data, actually.
And again, the row is kind of the widest thing of the signal.
Right.
So,
if that's the case, then.
Well, I mean, these are not single measurements. I mean, you have to measure with various light quark masses and then do a continuum and chiral extrapolation, which we don't really have the accurate enough data to have that all completely under control, especially with the unstable particles.
Since we're putting a magnified mass on it, the nucleon, you have the two lattice states and one experimental state.
Yeah, those are from two different sources, I think, yeah.
So in 10 years, what would be the picture here?
In 10 years?
I mean, in the fantasy, what would be the picture?
I'll answer for Esty. 10 years, this will be a picture of technihadrons and the calculations.
Yeah, something like that.
But if we still go to normal QCD, is this so you would have the K and the pi, you imagine?
Well, the K and the pi, we certainly, I mean, the K and the pi, we actually, I mean, those are used to fix lattice parameters. The predictions.
What would be the changes?
Well, the challenges will be that we'll have to face simulations where the rho, for example, is no longer stable, and so we have to deal with unstable particles on the lattice.
Can you calculate the weights, 150
mm-hmm. I mean that's what we will need to face that problem at some point and deal with it.
And also in the plot, it seems like I cannot find the lambda.
Because these are staggered fermions. These are staggered valence fermions. It's very difficult to construct operators that distinguish between the sigma and the lambda, for example. And we have not attempted to do that.
I have a question about the cohomological subsequentity.
Yes.
Yeah, historically, it can be obtained from the index. Okay, of a Dirac operator, right?
So presumably.
In this case, can you get the result from the index of a staggered operator or not? No.
No.
No. Then how can you compare using the spectral fold? Okay, you can also get the index and then get the topological subsequentity in this way.
It's a spectral flow of
H value with minus M0.
But they're using S-padded stellar from
but
it,
if
which is very sensitive to the topology. In order to use the fermion which is sensitive to the topology, they need to change the switch the fermion to
because they get already get the gauge configuration, right? With the gauge configuration, then you can look at the spectral flow of HW with minus M0.
You're welcome to do so.
And then
these are
the topologies are really obtained in this way.
In principle, yes. In practice, these are rough. The gauge configuration on the small scale, are very rough. And it's very difficult to implement a chiral operator on that. It's so difficult that people who want to do simulations with overlap type fermions or domain wall fermions, they take these configurations and do a couple or three or so hip smearing to smoothen it down so that the underlying then Wilson-Dirac operator has a small enough density of small eigenvalues that you can actually implement. That either when you do domain wall, you can get away with LS of 16 or so on, or if you would do overlap type fermions, you could actually make realistic simulations without having to first compute several hundred of eigenmodes to project out before you try to approximate epsilon. So no, it's, I mean, if you to get the index of your favorite operator on these configurations would be very difficult. And after you hip smear them, that's actually the way that the topological susceptibility was measured. The gauge fields were hip smeared, and then, and once you smear, then you can use a naive topological charge, and you get close to integer values.
Yeah, but of course, this depends on the gauge action you are using. You know that the domain of fermion people, for instance, use other gauge actions in order to make the gauge field smoother.
Except it doesn't work very well. As soon as you have dynamical fermions, you have to go to strong gauge couplings, and for a given lattice spacing, you have to go to much stronger gauge coupling.
I'm not talking about the residual mass. I am talking about the smoothness of the gauge.
No, but the residual mass is a direct consequence of the roughness of the gauge. Of the gauge configuration. If the gauge configurations are rough, your Wilson-Dirac operator at negative mass will have many small eigenvalues. If the gauge fields are smooth,
so you are so to say implying that if you would do a simulation with the other gauge action, you would have the same rough gauge field. Is that what you are implying?
I don't think it would help very much. I don't want to use another gauge action.
The RBC people have stated several times that the DBW or whatever it is does not work as well with dynamical.
Yes, for the reason that I just explained.
We discussed, I think, already also here, but it doesn't mean, I mean, it is not
it
as good as
the
in
best.
The French case. Yeah. But it is still much better than in, if you use another. For instance, Michel Weiss fermion for them. So it is.
I mean, I have no intention to go to the DBW2 action because I don't know what good it would do. Michel Weiss, I know at least in when I approach the continuum limits, it's an improved action that has a certain. Behavior, the lattice artifacts have a certain behavior, and
You still don't know it, and you just say that it presumably doesn't help, but you don't know whether it helps for the smoothness of the gauge field.
No, I don't know at these couplings. What I do know is that if you compare quenched configuration and dynamical configuration at the same long distance lattice spacing, determined from some long distance quantity. That on the short distance, the dynamical configurations are much rougher, no matter what gauge action you use.
Except for the last sentence, because if you never try another gauge action, then I don't know what, how can you conclude that whatever gauge action you use, because you are just using one gauge action.
Well, people have used other gauge action. RBC, for example.
Standard dynamical quartz.
Well, we have gauge configuration with Wilson action and standard staggered quark.
I think if I add a little bit more to what Urs wants to say, maybe as an item, there are tens of items, but I think the important thing, maybe third or fourth one, if I say about Dibitovic rule, I think it has its own thickness in the Kench simulation. It's well known. And so people, by looking at this very well-known comparison done by Tom DeGrand and Anna Hasenfratz, they already show that actually a lot of sectors, like topological sectors and many sectors, didn't move towards 2C. And at that stage, people already filtered for certain about that, okay, the semantic improvement, the gauge action might be the way they have to go. So with some prejudice. But in the post site, the hindsight, what happened was experimentally, the RBC collaboration figured out, okay, still using DBW2, they can change the topological sectors with dynamical fermions and blah, 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 that so and dance happens. But still, they also show that the residual mass has increased by order of magnitude in that simulation.
Compared to another gauge.
Right. So,
I think still, this is a little bit of
using DBW2 is still debatable.
RBC has done simulations with Wilson gauge and domain wall, and they've done simulation, so dynamical, and with DBW2 and domain wall. And at the same lattice spacing, where when in the quenched, the residual mass went down by almost two orders of magnitude going from Wilson to DBW2. In the dynamical, it was going down by less than an order of magnitude.
Yes, but this is not what we are interested in. We are interested in, forget about quenched, just taking both light dynamical quartz and changing the gauge action.
But that's what I just told you. Changing from Wilson to DBW2, yeah. They found that the residual mass went down by something like a factor of 4 or 5. So it went down. It went down. It became smoother. Okay. But the difference was much less than in the quenched case. I'm not saying that changing the, if you want to do domain wall type fermions, changing the gauge action cannot help some. But I'm saying that the effect will not be very large. And I'm interested, when I do these simulations, I'm interested in something else. I'm interested in something that has at least, that I know, that I understand, at least on the gauge part, what the approach to the continuum limit is more important for me here.
And I guess you could ask, how does the changing the action affect the case breaking in your game, right? How does it affect the case breaking would be the analog question.
Yes.
It's kind of the analog of the residual mass.
Well, Christine and some of her collaborators have started to look at this. With the different versions of smearing and the acid pad, which you know all have various claims as awful as X. So that's
kind of those is kind of mocking up. I mean, changing the gauge fields.
So basically,
that from what
well,
you
yeah. So well, yeah.
A posteriori, I mean, kind of after you've made ensembles.
Right. It's not changing the gauge action. It's changing the.
I mean, we certainly know that going from the Wilson gauge action to the Weiss action, quench, significantly reduced the case violation, which we under, least I understood by the fact that you were improving the approach and you were sort of removing the variance.
But even there, going from standard stagger to improved stagger, the effect was much larger than changing the gauge part of the action.
Right. So even the gauge part, the weird thing is that keep smearing gives significantly better performance in improving the breaking, the forever breaking, case breaking effect, reducing the case breaking effect. And so considering all those things, actually still people are claiming and using the S-step compared to the heap.
Well, that's because it's very hard to calculate the Fermi-Yau force.
I think that technically is reserved recently. They figured out how to do the
derivative.
HISC,
which is order A, it's semantic improved the way ASCAP is. But
with project,
it's even better on the technology and the taste breaking than the HIP.
And with some stout type construction, so that you don't have the projection, so that you can do dynamical simulations.
Stout is harsh.
Yeah, I know. No, but I mean, it's not only. I mean. HIP smearing involves projection, which is a non-analytic way, and so that gives impediments to dynamical simulations. Stout is something that is a way of projecting, I mean, making an SUN matrix that is analytic, so you can differentiate with chain rule and so on and do dynamical simulation.
HIP or stout.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But anyway.
I think it is a way of not projecting, but making an analytic way to go into SUN. And therefore, then you can take the derivative.
And not only that, going to from S-Cal, if we switch from S-Cal to the HIP, then basically we can do the topology using state from here too. So there are a bunch of advantages there moving from S-Cal to the HIP, but somehow you're stick with the S curves.
Well, I mean, basically we have a big.
You told us that this was invented last month, right? This is a many-year project, right? I don't understand how you could criticize this.
It's a question of, I mean, maybe do you want to build your church and, I mean, halfway up you switch from Gothic to Romanic, but in a really not very well put together fashion. I mean, we have this. But that has been done, yes. Sometimes with good results, sometimes not so aesthetically pleasing. So.
Because from the point of view of doing topology, there are two aspects. One is measuring the susceptibility. The other is the changing of the topology. So light fermion suppresses that.
Yeah.
How much are you affected in these simulations? Is when you say doing topology, that this action is favored over the other for doing topology, you don't mean the transition between the different topological sectors, right?
No.
Okay. And when you...
I would have to look or ask Carlton, but I think there is some slowing down that we see going to the final lattice from in the topology changing.
You want to go to lighter C-quark, so then.
That too. There are kind of going to lighter lattice space and going to lighter C-quarks are. I mean, well, you can do both, but I mean it's. But topology changing, even in quenched, even with Wilson action, just going to lighter and lighter, I mean, going closer to the continuum limit, the price, I mean, you pay for this dislocation gets larger and larger, and you start slowing down in topology changing there. And with the TBW2 at 3 GV, 3 inverse GV lattice spacing, they don't tunnel at all anymore.
I see.
Okay.